Welcome back to the Anarcho Book Club. So today we're going to finish up Kurt Vonnegut's book, Player Piano. And we'll start off today again with another poem. Now this poem is by John Updike, and it's called Player Piano. And I thought it was fitting for the theme. So I'm going to get into that. Let's see here. Okay, Player Piano by John Updike. My stick fingers click with a snicker, and chuckling, they knuckle the keys. Light-footed, my steel feelers flicker, and pluck from these keys melodies. My paper can caper, abandon, is broadcast by dint of my din. And no man or band has a hand in the tones I turn on from within. At times I'm a jumble of rumbles. At others I'm light like the moon. But never my numb plunker fumbles, misstrums me or tires a new tune. And so I picked that poem not just for the name, but also it kind of gives you an idea. It's a good description, I think, of what a player piano is. And a good description of what Vonnegut spells out in this book of his. It's it's a machine that produces sounds much like a human would. And in the poem, of course, Updike is giving us the imagery of stick fingers and knuckle and light-footed. He's giving us imagery of, what would you say, humanizing the machine, of anthropomorphizing the machine. And I think that's a good kind of introduction to the rest of this book, because the rest of this book focuses on the rise to the climax of the book and the revolution and focusing on the previous two revolutions, which lead to the third. And I've read a few different reviews and a few analyses and criticisms of the book, just to kind of get a feel for what other people may be thinking. And I kind of came away with the same ideas that they did, although they reading those kind of prepared me for actually talking about it. And one of the things that I came away with after completing this book is how the mechanization of life, of everyday life, seems to sort of dehumanize the people that it supposedly improves the lives of. And I think that's important, especially in, well, I mean, I hate it whenever people say especially in this day, because it's not especially in this day. It's especially in all the days since the book was written and before and before and before. And I was reading through my news my feed on Mastodon, and I saw a picture that someone posted of playground equipment back in the 50s and 60s, shaped like rockets and so on, and kind of space agey looking, and they said this was a product of the space race. And I couldn't help but think, my first thought was, what was the space race? Well, the space race was it was a race between the two great powers that came out of World War II, the United States and the Soviet Union. And it was a race, and they painted it as a race to the moon, a race to space, a race to get the first man in orbit around the world, the first man to complete orbit around the world, the first man to make it to the moon and step foot on the moon and plant the flag, a flag of ownership over the moon. But what it really was about, that was the propaganda given to us. And this isn't just some conspiracy theory. This is, I think if you read into it more and you read the history, you'll see it's true that the space race was a way to prove that one power had more powerful rockets than the other, and their rockets could reach the major cities faster and more accurately than the other, with nuclear bombs attached, of course, and or nuclear warheads, as it were, attached. And the space race was really a grotesque product of war, of Cold War at the time, as they say. Now, it wasn't so cold all the time. Both powers were funding different organizations around the world to attack the allies of each power. The Russians or the Soviets had their Afghanis that they funded. We had our Afghani people that we funded, or organizations that we funded to attack different parts of the Soviet Union. But ultimately, that playground equipment was a product of war. It was a product of the grotesque nature of government and the product of the grotesque nature of men and women, and back then probably mostly men, who rose up and they wanted to gain power over other people. They wanted to gain some sort of foothold at the top where they can, now they wouldn't paint it this way, but it is this way, where they can oppress and hold down those below them for their own profit, be it monetary profit or profit through power, profit through domination. And that's, and I know this sounds maybe like a tangent away from it, but I think that's part of the voice, part of the lesson to be learned from reading Player Piano and through Kurt Vonnegut's eyes of how the world was, and or how the world how the world might become. His eyes, so, and it's painted as progress. It's propagandized to the masses as progress. And I know in my past episodes I've kind of played around before I started and I launched into this great, monologue, as it were, about the book. But this one, it really, it's funny. It's funny whenever you read a book and you're in the middle of reading it, or you've just read it and you're still thinking about the different themes and the different schemas within the book, the different philosophical ideas that may spin out from this book. Everything you read online, regardless of how, regardless of the intent of the author or the artist, kind of seems to connect to it. It's a way that our minds make connections to the world we interact with. It's how mythology is built. It's how, and that's, oh, and speaking of mythology, that's the mythology of the past, the mythology of the 50s and 60s, the mythology, excuse me, of progress. And don't get me wrong, I do believe there is something such as progress to be had, but it's different for every person. And that's what an anarchist stands for. Finding your own progress through your own means. Finding progress through mutual aid, as it were. Finding some sort of personal progress. And the world be damned. That doesn't mean, of course, the world be damned as in maybe you care about the world. And that's a way that you can find your own progress by affecting change in the world. And that's great. But say I'm someone who just wants to affect change in my own life, which is something that I've kind of turned to as an anarchist, realizing that world change, even through direct action and even through some political action, something I've sort of realized is that kind of change is it's kind of a transient sort of change. Like in the book, in Player Piano, the revolution, what did they want? They wanted meaning. And that's another thing that I drew from it, and I found confirmed through the different articles that I'm not crazy. It is what they wanted. They wanted meaning, and even though they were provided for, sure, they were poor, the people in the homestead across the river, sure, they were poor, but they had, it was sort of a post-scarcity world in a way. None of them were going hungry, as it mentions earlier on in the book and later. But even through post-scarcity, none of them had meaning. Some people wanted to produce something. Some people wanted to do something that means something to them. And I think that's the major theme in the book. To find meaning. And in my opinion, now this is just for me, not for you. Maybe you find meaning in political action. But in my perspective, whenever I look out on the world and I think, I could join this movement or that movement and we could maybe affect some small change or some great change through some great act. Some great act of heroism. We could affect some great amount of change and change the world forever. And I think that would be nice, but I think that's also mythology. That's also some sort of mythology that we all want to believe in, but whenever it comes right down to it, the thing that most anarchists have found is unless you can change society as a whole, or unless you can change the actual psychology of society, there will be no change. And once the psychology of society changes, then comes the revolution, and then, and only then, is the revolution sustainable. The revolution against the powers that be, the powers that hold us down, the powers that, say, in 2008 and 2009, leveraged the government for how many trillions of dollars. And let's not even get into what is a dollar. They leveraged the government for all this money and said, let the people who owe money for their houses be damned. Let them all... Well, I'm sure that there were plenty of conversations about it, but in the message that was sent by the government sending millions and billions and trillions of dollars to these banks was... We care that you don't fail, but we don't care about the people who have lost everything, who have lost their jobs, hundreds of thousands of jobs disappearing overnight. We don't care about any of them. We only care about you guys, because you're the guys that pay us, who really pay us. And things like that can affect change. Things like that, and that didn't... That wasn't something, some great movement that came out of anarchy or the 1% movement or the 99% movement, whatever it's, I forget what it was called now. I'm blanking out. I was just thinking about it earlier this morning. But it wasn't, so the movement, the Wall Street protests that happened shortly thereafter when all these banks got bailed out, the Wall Street protests, they did something to raise awareness. And from that also came the right-wing movement, the Tea Party movement, which I remember whenever that was coming about. Initially, I thought, well, this is great. This is great. A lot of people on the right and left can now finally agree on something. But you know, eventually they both got co-opted by one party or another, or one special interest or another, and both of them sort of fizzled out. But the root of the book, I think, it comes back to the only way to change, to really affect change, is to affect your local society. And if everyone, every anarchist out there, really, really tried to change their local society through interactions, through trading with your local community, through interaction, if anarchists used their local society, not used, if they went into their local society and their local community and truly integrated with it and affected change, even if it's just with you and say you're in an apartment building and the people on your floor, you guys, you all practice normal things that would happen in a community, instead of staying closed off in your door or in your apartment behind your door, and instead of awkwardly avoiding each other, if you communicated with each other and eventually maybe even got into arguments with each other, uncomfortable as they might be, or just got into discussions, which would be better in my opinion, with each other, you could affect change in one person, and then another person, and it could spread much, much more quickly. And the best way to protest a government is to simply refuse to acknowledge that they have any power over you. Refuse to acknowledge that your government can tell you what to do whenever it goes against your, well, when it goes against your own moral judgment, or even if it doesn't. Because at that point, you're not doing it for your government, local government or otherwise. You're doing it because it is within your moral judgment. And these are the thoughts as I was reading Player Piano that came up in my mind. And I do think I did find an article by the Vonnegut Review where they're saying that his the society of Player Piano was one-dimensional. And I really do think that this being his first book, it maybe it's forgivable. Or maybe that was the intention, because this was kind of a comedy, maybe a black comedy. But it was still something like a comedic effort. But it's one-dimensional in that there are the people across the river, let's call them the 99%, and they're all basically the same. And then there are the people on the now what's his name? Paul, on well I forget his last name. Okay, on Paul's side of the river, who are all kind of the same as well, except for Paul maybe, and also with exception for well except for a few of them, but they all kind of work towards the same end goal. They all have the same or a similar outlook on life, or a similar perspective, a similar worldview. So maybe it is one-dimensional, but at the same time, that may be what society looks like to the one who looks on it from the outside whenever a societal change has happened. And it's never anything big. Nothing. Whenever the American Revolution happened, it wasn't some big, the Tea Party or whatever it was. It wasn't a big. Now, in the history books, they pinpoint these big changes. But it's always a gradual evolution in the mindset and the psychology of the society. And I think that's one thing that maybe Player Piano does kind of leave out. Although it alludes to it, I think, but it leaves it out, and maybe that's because that's not the direction. Of course, that's not the direction Vonnegut wanted to go in. But But yeah, that's kind of the so a lot of these people I see out here on, and I'm not on Twitter anymore, but I still see tweets every now and then. I see them call a call to action. I see them calling people to come and protest and come and do this and come and do that. And okay, that's fine. That's great. But if you think that that's going to change anyone's minds, if you think that's going to get more people thinking for themselves, I think you may be a bit deluded. Or I think maybe your focus is too narrow and too hyper-focused on a single point, a single idea. I think you may have mythologized the idea and ideals of anarchism too much, because if you're like I was even a year ago, maybe not a year ago, even 2 years ago, if you're like I was, you may kind of mythologize the idea of anarchism so much that you don't criticize it at all. And maybe you'll buy into what your fellow green anarchists and anarcho-communists and or whoever, whatever sect you want to put yourself in, you buy into what they say without question. And maybe it's because it does agree with your mentality, and that's fine. But if you're not able to step back and criticize the thing that you profess, there's a dangerous line there that you may cross, where you turn your ideals and ideas of anarchism into something of a religion that cannot be gone against, cannot be disputed. And that's something I always realize with my own thoughts. I always realize that, or I always try to think, is this becoming something, is one idea or another becoming something that I am too afraid to let go of if I find any flaws in the philosophy or in the ideals of it? And that's one thing I've let go of. So whenever I started out, I was, and many of you may howl with anger and sadness at this, but I started out as in my journey through anarchism, as a not anarchist, but as someone who read Atlas Shrugged and We the Living from Ayn Rand. And although those books resonated with some internal ideas in my own mind, there was something bothering me about the philosophies I found in Ayn Rand's books, namely her seeming unwavering devotion to some sort of a state. And eventually I found myself questioning all of it, everything that she preached. But I came away with it with a respect for Ayn Rand, a certain amount of respect. Although many of her ideas I find them relatively repulsive, I still find an amount of respect for her putting forth her philosophy and letting it be criticized, and letting it kind of evolve over time, though she may, if she were alive today, she may dispute it ever evolving, because she seemed to think that everything was set in stone and solid. At least from my readings and watching of her interviews. But that's where I came from. And eventually I found Murray Rothbard and Ludwig von Mises and Hayek and all of these different. They would call themselves, I think, libertarians or anarcho-capitalists. Or at least now that's what they're called. And I found that comforting because it was something that I understood and knew, and I mythologized in my own mind the ideals of the market and the infallibility of the market. And now that is a very nuanced conversation that we can have later, maybe, but but only recently, only in the last couple of years, have I even left that utter devotion to an ideal such as capitalism. It took me a while of writing blogs, blog articles, and being criticized for it, and realizing that maybe not everything that I think is right is, or that I think is reality, is in fact reality. Maybe not. And eventually I came to where I am now, where I don't really ascribe to, or prescribe, perhaps it is, to any individual flavor of anarchy. I look at look across the board and see them all, and I think everything has its place. Everything has a good, all of these ideals and ideas have something of a good foundation, I think, or most of them do. And there's things that, and eventually I came to realize, and I realized this before whenever I was doing my degree in English, or in literature, in languages, I realized that you don't have to pigeonhole yourself into, I'm an anarcho-syndicalist, I am an anarcho-capitalist, I am an agorist, I am this, I am that. You don't have to do that. You can say you are an anarchist. And you can read a book like Player Piano by Kurt Vonnegut and say, I find value in many of the ideas written down on this paper, or printed on this e-ink screen, or on this computer screen. And you can read Kafka, any of his, really, The Trial, or The Metamorphosis, the one that we read, and you can say, I find great value in some of these ideas. And that, my dear listener, is called being human, I think. I think it's called being human, or called being an individual, to realize that you don't have to say anything, you don't have to label yourself, you don't have to pigeonhole your ideas and force your mind into a mold for anyone, unless it is, of course, your intention to do that. You don't have to do these things. You can just say, if someone asks, well, you don't even have to say you're an anarchist, for that matter. I don't think there's maybe some value in it if you're a public-facing individual, but I don't think there's much value interpersonally to call yourself an anarchist unless you're just that proud of it. You're proud of being a human, maybe, because I think most humans would call themselves anarchists if they truly understood what it was. I think most human beings would see that they wake up in the morning and say they brush their teeth, well, they have the choice to brush their teeth or not. And that is an anarchic decision. That is a decision without force, I think is what we could call it. There's no force being applied to them to make that decision. And now some of my anarchist friends may say, ah, but there is force keeping them from making that decision. And maybe that's true. Maybe it is. But on the base level, on the top level, it might be, there's no force being applied. They don't wake up and say, I have to brush my teeth, or the government will come, or some person will come and break my kneecaps, or throw me in a cage. They can make decisions for themselves, and that is being an anarchist. It's simply being a human and an individual. Now, in Player Piano, there wasn't a whole lot of individuality going on. And I chose this book because I, frankly, had not read Vonnegut for a long time, and I remembered there being some themes that may be useful here. And there are a lot of other themes, but for a 45 to an hour long conversation, 45 minute to an hour long conversation, there we can't cover everything. Of course, this is part two. So I wanted to touch on all of these things, and then kind of shift or transition, metamorphize to what is the player piano in the end? The player piano is the society across the river that they mill about as if they also too are automated machines. And I haven't even mentioned the idea of the supercomputers and all of that. That's a whole nother discussion that I wish I could get into, but I really want to move on to the next books. And we'll touch that in future episodes, I think. But society has become automated in Player Piano. And hasn't society become automated in the United States or in Australia or in the UK or in Germany or wherever you are in the world? Would you not say that your society is somewhat automated? Say you have, everyone has a smartphone nowadays, it seems. Not everyone, of course, but most people do. And if you've watched the documentary, and I don't know how much of it you can take to heart, but I think the overarching theme of the documentary, The Social Dilemma, if you've watched it, you'll see that maybe your decisions are not quite as individualized as you may. As you may suppose they are. And you see, you've got your smartphone, and if you just buy into it and you say, this is my device for everyday use, and I'm going to just use whatever they've given me on here and download the apps that they suggest, and so on and so forth, and maybe you go off the rails a bit and download an app that wasn't suggested to you, but one of your friends suggested this app. That was all orchestrated from the beginning by the great advertising corporation known as Google or Apple. And sure, people say, well, my Apple phone's much, much more secure than yours, but it's not. It's still controlled by a corporate entity. Maybe it is a little bit more difficult to hack into, but I even doubt that. I seriously doubt that. So, you have your phone, this supercomputer in your pocket, as it has been labeled so many times, and it tells you what to do at all times. And God forbid you go against that. God forbid. And you accept the automation, you accept the chains, you accept all of the negative that comes with the convenience. And this is the mechanization of humanity. This is creating good citizens, which is the well, that is the well, it is the very purpose of public education. It is the only stated purpose of public education. That is to create good citizens, good serfs, good slaves to the government, good tax cattle. But it's not just for the government. Schools, they have major influence from Google and Apple. If you remember in 2000, what was it, 6 or 7? Apple made a huge effort to get MacBooks in every, at least in colleges. And Google, back then, in 2011, I was one of the first testers for the CR48 Chromebook. And I wish I still had it, but it got stolen out of my car. They got their Chromebooks in so many high schools and middle schools now. At my job, I've seen how I've talked to parents, and they say, yeah, their school gave them a laptop. It's a Chromebook. And it's great because Chromebooks, they're a cheap computer that can do a lot of things, and the teachers can have full control over everything that the child sees, be it online or in the classroom. But they've gotten their devices into these schools, into these universities. Everybody gets a Chromebook. Everybody gets a laptop. Everybody gets a Windows computer. Everybody gets something, and it's built into the price of your college or your education, as it were. And education, its sole purpose is to create good citizens, as stated in their charter. Its sole purpose is also to create good digital citizens now, which maybe that's not in their charter, but by virtue of Google and Apple and Microsoft getting their devices into these schools to be used by children so that they can collect more data on these children and on these university students and college students. By virtue of that, they're able to make another buck off the backs of the tax cattle, off the backs of the serfs. And so this conversation has shifted from Player Piano just a bit, but it is in the spirit of Player Piano that I then say, maybe you should buy a regular piano. And by buy, of course, it's free to invest and use open source free software. You buy a computer, say, I have quite a few little computers, but I have two main computers, the one I'm recording this on, which runs Slackware Linux, and then I have a little Asus EPC that runs, it ran OpenBSD until recently. I put Slackware on it too, because I'm neurotic and want my operating systems to match, unfortunately. So, or maybe that's OCD, I don't know. And I use only open source free software in all of my computing life, save for my phone. But that'll change soon. I also have a Pine phone so that I can free myself from the chains of the Android ecosystem. And I say all these things not just to brag, because I do love saying, oh, look at my devices. It's kind of an ego boost to say it out loud and on a podcast, but also to say this is a way to free yourself from what you may call a tyranny of the big three software makers in the world. You can free yourself from the constant watching of big corporate entities, which feed the information to your government, of course. If you use a VPN and you think, I'm safe from that, I don't need that, and you use a MacBook or Windows computer, you can still be assured that you are being spied on, even with your VPN. Maybe they can't see your browsing history, but they can still see the things that you type. They still record the things that you say via Cortana and via Siri, as it were. They still can see everything and use everything that you produce to make a buck on your back and to guide you in the way that they think you ought to act. And Player Piano, these are player pianos in your pocket or on your desk. These are Kurt Vonnegut's machines that will passively force you to, if that is a possibility or a possible good combination of words, passively force you to their will and bend you to their ideal, and you become at the base level a good citizen and a good tech citizen. And the way to break free from that is to investigate alternatives, to break free from being just another drudge across the river, and maybe rise up and have your own little quiet revolution against the powers that would direct your attention hither and thither. You can embrace, investigate, and use on a daily basis something that won't spy on you, and that is free software. And that's just, and this isn't me, my own little just pedestal to promote free software and to promote, say, Linux or the BSDs or Slackware, although it does come highly recommended from yours truly. This is a way to just tell you, don't trust your devices, because your devices are part of the ecosystem that we have just read. Don't if you don't want to be a machine in the or a cog in the great machine of this of this tyrannical system that we have, and we must admit that we have contributed to the building of. You can just remove yourself from it by embracing these alternatives. And you can reach out to me too, and I'll help you. There's an entire the thing about free software and the free software community is there is a community. There's an entire community of people who are more than happy to help you leave the chains of big tech and embrace something that will enable you and those whom you love, or who you love, it will enable you to protect yourself against maybe that outside influence. It'll inoculate you, or it will attempt to inoculate you against that. And maybe you can take your cog out of that machine, and if one person does it, and they get two other people to do it, and so on and so forth, we can cripple the machine. The machine that replaces us. And this isn't a call to action or a call to revolution, so to speak, but it goes back to what we started out with, and that is change yourself in your local community. Well, no, first, change yourself to be consistent and act according to your own conscience. And read books, which is what I want for my listeners to do. Read books that will help you expand your own mind and help you understand your own sense of morality or your own sense of ethics and develop your own ethics. Because without the state, and if you are one who is an anarchist and an atheist, without the state and without a god to give you your ethics, that just means, it doesn't mean that you have no ethics. You still have ethics, unlike what the Christians have argued for decades now in all of these great debates between Hitchens and all these people, and Sam Harris, and all of them. All of these debates I watched whenever I was younger. And it was always argued that if you're an atheist, you have no ethics. And the same goes if you're an anarchist, you have no patriotism, or you have nothing that can hold you to account. And that's not true, you see. But you have to develop your own sense of ethics. You have to develop your own sense of morality. And you can start by reading books and critically analyzing them. Books like Player Piano that touch on these issues. And then developing your own ideas. And mine, my personal sense of ethics and morality have led me to only using free and open source software. My reading of these books has led me away from the Misesian, Rothbardian, Ayn Randian senses or different sorts of ethics, and towards a broader spectrum. And that's what I wanted to start this whole blog or podcast for, was to review books to help people maybe get excited to read different points of view that may disagree with them. And that's why I don't intend to just cover the books by anarchists that are acceptable to the majority of anarchists. I intend to cover the anarcho-capitalists eventually. I intend to cover some of the more right-wing or far left-wing that may not agree with the majority of anarchists. I intend to cover all of them so that we can all grow together. But as for Player Piano, I thought it was a great book. I love reading books from authors that it's their first book ever, because you can see kind of some of their weaknesses. Usually, although Vonnegut didn't have a whole lot of weaknesses in this book, I don't think, not in my opinion, but you can see some of the weaknesses, and then you can compare it to his future books, which I would obviously recommend you read all of his other books when you get a chance. But for now, that's kind of my take and the things that Player Piano brought up in my own mind. So now, let me see here. I'm going to take a sip of coffee, and I will introduce our next book. So for our next book, It is a poem, or a series of poems, by Walt Whitman. I mentioned it actually in the first episode. Walt Whitman was one of Emma Goldman's heroes, and he wrote a huge collection of poems by the end of his life. He revised it, I think, 3 or 4 times. It's been a while since I've read it, but called Leaves of Grass, or Song of Myself. And there are, though it's a very, pre-modern era American, or United States, States United American, style of literature. But it's also a very pro-liberty, in the most liberal sense of that word, series of poems, or book, as we'll call it. And you may have noticed in the last 2 episodes, this episode and the last, I have kind of gotten a little bit more into reading poetry at the beginning, and it got me thinking, why don't we just do a whole book of poetry? And I know poetry is not always everyone's favorite type of literature, but I think my fellow readers, that this series of poems may just pique your interest a little bit more than what you're used to. Maybe in high school or college you read Shakespeare. It's nothing like that. This reads more like a book, but in line-by-line form. And it's a lot easier to reference than a book, because it is structured it's much more structured, so that I can reference, say, paragraph 4, line 3 of this poem, or this specific poem in this book of poems. And it will be the same no matter which version you get, whether it be the one that I publish on the website, or be it the version that you find in your local library, or that you've owned for the last 10 years and have never opened. So we're going to cover this. I'm just going to read through the whole thing and kind of pick out themes that I want. And this is one that next week I will not be having, I won't be recording anything for this book. I may, if I have time, I may record kind of a discussion track that I can upload. But we won't be covering this until a week, or wait, what day is it? I should have looked this up before I said any of this. So next Friday is the 19th, so the 26th is when we will discuss Song of Myself, or Leaves of Grass. So you have 2 weeks to read this, and it's easily digestible. None of the poems are just terribly, horribly long. Some of them may take a while to get through, but I think you'll enjoy it. I always enjoy it. I take a lot from a lot of the things that I remember, like quotes, come from this, and I never remember where they came from, because this is a very long, or a relatively long work of poetry. So yeah, that's what we'll be reading over the next 2 weeks, and I may have an interim episode between this Friday and the Friday of the 26th of February. So go grab that off the site. You can get it just about anywhere. You can buy a copy of it for almost nothing at most local bookstores. I own quite a few copies of this book, because there are actually, let me just look it up. I think it is Leaves of Grass. There are 1, 2, 3, 4. It looks like four, maybe arguably five editions of this book. And I will be using whatever edition is on Project Gutenberg. I believe that's the last one, his quote-unquote deathbed edition, the one he said was finished. So go grab a copy, and we'll read through that, and then I will post my thoughts, and hopefully you guys can reach out to me wherever you are on Mastodon, and we'll discuss it. So that's it for today's episode. I hope you guys enjoyed it, and I hope you have a great day.